So remember where we left it yesterday? Yesterday was so long ago. Yes.
We had some planes and cars out there.
Yes. So maybe we'll get back to that topic. As you've noticed, I'm good at taking tangents here and there. So, but yes, we're in the course itself. We left it at the principles. Someone has a phone here charging. Yes. Okay. Good. I was just want to make sure it was not the TAs. So yesterday I talked about three sort of high-level principles from Norman, which I find quite good because they are high-level. And so, as we'll see in the next slide, you know, you can find books that have tens, hundreds of rules. And for every rule, there are exceptions. And for every exception, there are exceptions to the exception. So if you make too many rules at some point, it's not a good thing. So I like this high-level rules because I think they cover really the important points, make things visible so people know what they're dealing with, make the mapping... hello? Maybe you should have a better battery on your thing because you lay it every time, so... the mapping principle, so users understand how the thing works. It's as simple as that, in a sense. How their actions, what are the effects of their actions, and what it is they're seeing, and how the state of the system is visible, so they know what is possible or not. And then feedback, and I should have feedback and feed forward. So feedback about what the user is doing, and feed forward about what the user can do at any point in time. And as I said, so a lot of people have created more detailed guidelines and rules and recommendations. These ones are from Schneiderman. You recall that name? Remember that name? Have we seen that name before? Yeah? searching. Oh, come on. I think, you know, with this idea that all things can be externalized on these devices now, you don't need the brains anymore, right? You don't need to, yeah? That's a sad evolution. Memory is good. So, Ben Schneiderman, anybody has found it in their slides yet? All right, I'm going to wait. It was in the lecture number, I don't know, week two. Graphical interaction. Yes, thank you. You can thank her. yes, direct manipulation, Ben Schneiderman articulated, spelled out the principles, the four principles of direct manipulation. And that was back in 1983. This is from, not sure why I say 98. Ben Schneiderman is a co-author, main author of one of the main textbooks in HCI. And so I suspect I took it out of there. So he has this eight design rules. Number one, consistency. So why do we want consistency? Yes?
To predict how the interface will work and to predict the user patterns.
Yes, so to predict how it works and so you don't have to learn different ways of doing things that are in the end similar. And so a lot of the guidelines you find, you know, if you try to program an app for iOS or an app for Android or app for another operating system, they come up with all this list of guidelines where, you know, in a particular type of dialog box, the OK button should be down right because that's where people will expect to see it, and etc. So consistency, you know, can be sort of refined into all these detailed rules about how to make things that work the same, look the same, and interact in the same way. Shortcuts for expert users. We want interfaces where novices or intermittent users, someone who uses a piece of software once every 6 months or something, can use the software, but also that people can become expert and become more efficient. So that's shortcuts like keyboard shortcuts, but there are other kinds of shortcuts and ways to make experts efficient. Informative feedback, that links to the feedback principle from Don Norman. Design dialogues with closures. What does this mean? A dialogue with a closure is a dialogue where you specify something, and then the system responds and asks for more information, and then you give the information, and the system maybe asks for more. So you know, if you shop online and you have all this thing of put stuff in the cart, and then you go to the cart and you want to pay, and you have and you have all these steps, and the closure is you want to know when you're done. And you want to know, well, first where you are in the dialogue, but also when you're done. And I take the example of these shopping websites, because sometimes, you know, you click the button at the end and you don't know if it has worked or not. In fact, sometimes they tell you, don't click twice. You know that? Because it could charge your credit card twice if you click twice. Yeah. Which is, sorry, but I don't know who programmed this, but not a good designer. So closure is the notion that, you know, when you engage onto a certain path, you know when where you are and when things are done. Prevent errors and help repair them. Ideally, your interface should not let users make errors. So you have examples of typical things that are done in user interfaces to avoid errors. Yes?
Putting a calendar and but not typing a wall date.
Okay, so instead of typing a date where you can make all sorts of mistakes, having a calendar where you click. Okay, so that's to alleviate input errors. Yes, good example. Another one, yes?
Autocorrect.
Autocorrect. Yes? Although autocorrect, does it always autocorrect correctly? I like the reaction. You know, there
it tries
hard. You know, there are entire websites with big fails due to autocorrect. You know these ones. Anyway, I will avoid this. No, but it happens all the time that people type something, it's autocorrected, and then puts them in an embarrassing situation. So I wouldn't say that autocorrect prevents errors, but tries to mitigate errors. I had you first, and then you. Yes?
Well, more generally, any kind of widget where you have a finite number of things you can select or click, so you don't have to input the thing yourself. You choose what the system
is. Yeah. So it's a little bit like the calendar example,
yeah,
but more generally. Yes?
Having revision history to defer back to previous versions.
Aha, revision history. So that would be more the repair side. So you made something, you made a mistake, you want to go back. But yes, that's a good. Now there's one obvious one that, yes?
You said disable buttons.
Yes. Grayed out items in menus or disabled buttons. Yes? That kind of like killed it. Who else? Yeah. Yes?
Why?
Yeah. Why is, does it avoid errors?
Uh-huh.
Well, say you have a menu with cut, copy, and paste.
Yeah.
Typically, the cut item is going to be grayed out if there is nothing selected.
Yeah.
If it were not grayed out, you would click cut and it would pop up a thing saying, oh, there is no selection. So that would be an error. But your point is well taken that what is an error? There is the error in the sense that the user didn't do what he or she wanted to do, there's an error where you try to get the system to do something that is not allowed. So there are a whole typology of errors. There was another, yes?
Confirmation dialogues.
Confirmation dialogues. So how does this work? When they say, are you sure you want to do this? Does this prevent errors? Yeah. Yeah. It's never happened to you that you see the dialog box so often that you click, and the one time you wanted to cancel, you already had clicked OK. It happens to me. But yeah, it's a good example too. And there was one more here.
In the input for putting the card number, sometimes there is only four numbers, and that is a regular expression to
Yeah. So, for example, something that drives me crazy, when you enter a credit card number, that it does not allow you to enter spaces. Because on my credit card, I see four digits and a space and four digits. And my visual system can parse four digits at once, but not 16. Same thing with phone numbers, where same thing, you have to put everything. And, you know, it would be easy to remove the spaces and see if it's correct card number. So that's a case where this kind of details can really make users make a lot of more errors. But yes, checking with a regular expression. Now, if you cannot prevent errors with one of these techniques, you should make it easier for the user to repair them. And again, sometimes an error is not an error for the system. So if you trashed a file, well, the system trashed the file. There's no error there. But maybe it's not the one you wanted to trash, and so for you it was an error. In that case, you want to be able to repair. And so for repair, the classic approach is undo, or as you say, even a longer history. And if the thing cannot be undone, that's a good time where you can have this annoying dialogue saying, are you sure you want to do this? But that should be really limited to the exceptional cases. A good example is the invention of the trash. I mean, the trash was invented so that deleted files were not really deleted. If you are on Linux and you type rm for remove a file, the file is gone. It doesn't go to the trash, right? And that's, you know, the world we lived in until 1975. And the trash appears. So repairing errors is important because if you make errors repairable, people will more likely explore and more likely become fluent and expert at using the system. Provide reversible operations. To me, this is kind of a subset of this, because reversible is when you've done something, being able to undo it. And so I guess the thing is sometimes you want to explore, and even though you're not making errors per se, you want to be able to do things that you want to later undo just to see if what it did or if it is what you wanted to do. Give control to the user. To me, that's not a very, compared to the other recommendations, kind of vague. Give control to the user means that well, you want the user to be able, for example, to interrupt something that takes a long time. But if something is going to take a long time, you also want to tell the user maybe in advance and make it cancelable. And the last one here, reduce short-term cognitive load. So the idea is that when you use an interface, you typically need to have stuff in your memory about the state of the system. And so that links to the make the state visible from the previous slide, because you need to keep in your head the state that you don't see. The typical example is in a VI-like interface, where you have to know if you are in insert mode or in command mode. And if there's nothing on the screen to tell you, you have to remember that. Yes? What?
Like you have a line of text at the bottom of the editor.
Yeah, I said VI. I didn't say Vim.
Oh, it's not in VI.
No, it's not in VI. VI was for, you know. yeah, no, in VI there's no way of, and I don't remember which key combination you'd use, so you could tell by without having to undo what state you were in. Anyway, but more generally, it's good to think about what happens if you get to the system without, you know, any context, and if you try to understand what the state of the system is, and what needs to be kept in your head as you use the system. And I, as it says here, there are dozens of recommendations, hundreds of rules, there are entire books. This quickly goes into the field of human factors and ergonomics. In human factors and ergonomics, a big thing is to collect rules and make it so, in a sense, you almost don't have to design anymore because you just follow the rules and you say, well, for this situation, I have this solution. For that situation, I have this solution. I don't think that in the end results in very good design, because the design of a system is a more holistic thing. It's not just by having little pieces that you glue together that you necessarily get a good interface. And also, there's always situations where it makes sense to break the rule. And I think the talent of a designer is also to know when to break the rules. Right? And so you can look examples on the systems you use. I mean, trying to think of one, but I know Apple, for example, is the first one to break their rules in their own apps on their operating system that are not, in a sense, consistent. So, of course, if you break rules, you're going to break consistency to some extent. So it's always a trade-off. And the point is, design is trade-off. Applying rules is a good starting point, but then you have to figure out what works and what doesn't in a particular situation or with a particular group of users. So the question then becomes, well, how do we go about conceptualizing the interface before we get to the details of what buttons is going to be where and things like this? How do we organize the interface? How do we make sure that it has the features we want it to have? And how can we check that the interface has certain good properties, such as consistency? And so we go back to this picture. Remember that picture? Okay, a better memory for diagrams than for people's names. Yes? Yes. Visual memory. You know that your brain is different than mine? Sorry, I'm going on a tangent again. But there's been studies. So I was watching the other day an old movie. No recollection what it was. And it struck me how slow it was. It's like, you know, every shot is super slow, takes a long time. And then it was on the same evening, I was watching another thing, a documentary or something. And I was like, I can't see anything. It's all too fast. So now if you take a piece of video that's been edited recently, the shots are usually no more than 2 seconds long. A few years ago, it was more like 4 seconds. So now we're down to 2 seconds. You are bombarded constantly by interruptions on your various devices, right? In fact, software now is having this feature, so you know it blacks out the rest of the screen so you can concentrate, because we know that we're distracted all the time. And studies have shown that, in fact, in this world where we're constantly bombarded by information, and these things that change all the time, that interrupt us all the time, changes the way our brain gets wired. And a particular problem is that in schools now, the kids cannot sit down for an hour and attend a lecture. That's just too much for them. So this has really nothing to do with what I wanted to say here, except that, yes, so I'm not surprised you have better visual memory than memories of things like names or words. So you remember this diagram. In this diagram, I explain. Do you remember the explanation that went with it? Not really at this point, but. So what I explained is that when you interact with a system, essentially you're entering commands in that system. You want to tell it to do things, right? So while you enter this command, you want some feedback that indeed the system is at least, I don't want to say understanding, but taking your input into account. So if you type on the keyboard, you expect the characters to show up on the screen, right? If they didn't, that would be frustrating. When you're moving the mouse, you expect the cursor to change. Maybe you expect things to highlight if you click on them, etc. So this is all the feedback while you are specifying what you want the system to do, while you are specifying the command. Then, at some point, this command... that's interesting. This diagram got screwed up. So it's not exactly the diagram you saw before. Let me see if I can quickly fix it. I'm doing something dangerous here, editing something live. And, ooh, look at that. And this one? Okay, well, you get the idea. Yes. And, okay, that was the diagram. Nobody noticed that it was the wrong one, including me. So anyway, once you've specified a command, that command, which can be a text you type in a command line interface, can be clicking on buttons and dialog boxes, can be a speech input, something you say to the computer, it gets turned into an operation or several operations that the system is going to do on its internal objects. So it's what the command does. So if I say, if I drag the icon of a file to the trash, that's my command. The operation is going to be delete that file. And so this operation operates on internal objects. You probably expect a response, something to happen in reaction to your command. To show you that it has been executed correctly or not if you get an error. And so that's what I call the response.
Excuse me.
Yes?
What is mean by objects there? Means, for example, if we type a command on Linux prompt.
Yes.
For example, rm-r, then in that case, which will be the object?
Well, the object would be the file.
A file for...
The
command file?
No. If you say rm some file... The object is the file. If you say, put that object from the catalog in my cart on the shopping site, well, the objects are the objects that are in the catalog. Another object is the shopping cart. So it's the internal objects of your system. It can be database entries, can be anything. Now, of course, these objects, usually you see some representation of them on the screen, so you interact with their representation, and the power of graphical user interfaces is that when you see an icon on the screen, for you the icon is the file. And, you know, in reality the icon is not the file. Yes? The icon is a bunch of pixels on the screen, the file is something hidden on your hard drive somewhere, right? But you don't even think of that. The file on the screen is the file. So we have this 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 things, commands and feedback, trigger operations on internal objects, and generate responses. Something changes on the screen, or you get a beep, or you get some message in response, so you know that something has happened. And that's going to be the conceptual model. These five things are going to be the basis for the conceptual model. Now, you can do that in different orders, but in general, it's a good way to do it is to start with the objects. What are my objects? What is my interface for? What it is I want the users to interact with? If I do a word processing system, it's going to be the text document, and the text document, it's made of paragraphs and sentences and words and all these things. If I'm doing a shopping site, to take that example again, the objects are the catalog, the products in the catalog, but also the shopping cart, etc. So these are the objects. Once you have the objects, you can start thinking about the operations. What is it that I want to do with those objects? In general, the operations are fairly easy to identify, because essentially what you want to do is, for each type of object that you have, is the user, do you want the user to be able to create some of these objects, or are they sort of already pre-existing? So if you're on a shopping site, the catalog is there, and you don't expect the user to be able to add things to the catalog, neither to remove them from the catalog. But if you do a word processor, you want the user to be able to create new paragraphs and words and sentences and delete them. And the other thing is, you want to decide which properties of these objects the user is allowed to change. Once you have the objects and the operations, then you can start thinking about, okay, what interface really or interactions I'm going to build for the user to control these operations. And so then you want to identify the commands, how the user will activate the operation. As you define a command, you also specify its feedback and the response that it will have. Now, what's valuable about this is that there's a systematic aspect to it. And in the course, of course, of the process, you may change your mind about what the objects are and what the operations are, and maybe you need new objects that you didn't think about at first. But the fact that you can keep track of these essentially three types of things, objects, operations, and commands, you can start putting them into what I call interaction tables. And so one way that you can represent that is to have two tables, the objects table and the operations table. And so in the object table, you say, well, I have a type of object, it's going to be the files, because I'm doing an interface for manipulating files. And then I have operations here, and you can list all the operations on this file. You want the user to be able to delete the file, maybe to create a new blank file, maybe to rename the file, etc. So we have the objects and operations, which, as I show you here, were the sort of internal part of your interactive system. And then once you have that, in the other columns of these two tables, you can look at how this is going to be viewed from the user perspective. So for each type of object, well, remember the principle, we want objects to be visible. So how are these objects going to be visible? If I have a file, how do I represent the file? Well, it can be an icon, and the picture of the icon depends on the file type. It has a name that I want to display next to the icon, but maybe I can also describe different representations. So here I could have another representation for that same object that says, well, it's a line in a table, if you do a list view of your files. Now, to make sure that you represent the things that are relevant to the user, it's useful to list the properties of these objects. So a file, well, it has a path, it has a file type, as we said, it has a name, it also has a size, it also has a content. Now, once you have identified the properties that are relevant, and I insist on this, relevant to the user. For the programmer, you probably need a bunch of other information, but from the user perspective, you identify what is useful or important. You can ask yourself, where is there a representation where each of these properties is visible. And if there is no representation where you can actually identify the property, well, why do you need this property? So that's the kind of checks that this type of organization lets you do. And then you list the operations that you want to enable on these objects. And as I said before, the easy way to think about it is, can I create it? Well, can the user create it? Can the user delete that type of object? How can the user change each of these properties? So there, I have a name property, so I have a rename. But I don't want the user to be able to change the type of the file, because the file type is specified usually when you create it and likely to change. But at least it forces you to ask yourself the question, well, should the user be able to change the type? And there are cases where it is. On the macOS interface, if you rename a file and change the suffix, it will ask you, are you sure you want to change this .jpg into a .pdf? And usually the answer is no, because it's not the same format, so it's not going to work. But sometimes it makes sense to do this kind of thing. So here we have the objects on the left, the operations on the right, and then properties and representations in the middle. In the second table, it's driven by the operations. So the first thing to make sure is that all the operations you have listed here are in that table somewhere. So I have a delete operation on the file. So I have here something called delete a file. And here, what we're going to do in this table is look at the interaction, command, feedback, response. So how do I delete a file? Well, the command is where you describe the interaction, what the user is going to do to delete a file. So it can drag and drop the icon into the trash. It can select the file with a click and then hit the delete key, for example. But maybe you can also talk to the computer and say delete file or something like this. So again here, it can have multiple commands. And usually, it's a good idea to have multiple commands for the same operation. And then you can refine what happens in response to this command. What is the feedback that the user is getting as he's drag and dropping, or as he is selecting and hitting the delete key? So in the first case, you want the icon to move with the cursor into the trash. And the response at the end is the icon of the file disappears. Maybe the trash gets bigger. Maybe you hear a sound like, you know, you've thrown something down the trash can. And similarly for the other type of interaction. So it's really decomposing all the interaction of your interface into this sort of building blocks. Note that at this point, I obviously have made some assumption about how the interface looks, but I haven't drawn any wireframe. I haven't decided really much of anything about how it's actually going to look. Now, I'm not saying you don't have you should not do it. I think to think about how these things work together is useful to have an idea of how the interface will look on the screen, if it's a visual interface, but it's not what is driving the design. What is driving the design is really, what are the objects, what are the operations? And that lets you think about, well, is the user going to understand that in his mental model, will it build the right objects and operations that I have put in my model? So by putting them up front, you increase the chances that the mental model will match the conceptual model. Does this make sense? Yes? Now, I can guarantee that you're going to make big mistakes trying to do this. And I'm speaking of experience. Did you have a question? No, I saw your hand move, so I thought. Sorry. So every time students try to use this, most of you will make the mistake, which is that when I talk about objects here, I am not talking about interactive objects like menus or buttons or things like this. Because an OK button is not an object in my mental model of an interface. It's not an internal object of my interactive system. It's something that I've put somewhere in the dialog box because I've decided about a certain type of interaction. So the OK button or the menu item XYZ can be listed here, but never here. Never here. Yes?
But that's for your system, right? So in another system, a button could be an object.
Well, if I'm designing an interface builder, the objects of the interface builder are buttons and things. So, yes.
So it depends on...
Yeah, but that's kind of sort of a self-referential thing. But no, the thing is, you want to think of the objects that are the objects that what Schneiderman calls the objects of interest of the user. And a menu is not an object of interest. A window in itself is not an object of interest. The document in the window is an object of interest. And so what I see time and again here is people draw the interface and they look at all the things they've drawn and say, oh, these are my objects. No, some of them are, a lot of them are just interface objects for the interaction, but they are not the objects of interest of the user.
Relate to the user, the final actions that they want to do. So if you have a text editor, for example, you want to have a search feature, so that would be a technical object, would you say?
Like so what, the search feature?
Yes. Or like they want to have, like to import images or the like. Would that kind of work as an object?
If you have a verb, search, import, it's likely to be an operation. Now, of course, reification can kick in and turn it into an object. Like aligning can be a command, but if I introduce a new object, the guidelines I showed you last week, then it becomes an object. And that, I think, what's fun about designing this thing is that, you know, you can just say, well, here's my object, and then have this long list of verbs, and these are my operations. But sometimes you can get a lot more power by turning some of those into new objects that you hadn't thought of in the beginning. But if you really give them the status of real objects that the user will understand, then it can get very powerful.
Okay.
Yes?
Is every operation tied to an object?
That's a good question. There can be exceptions. You have an exception in mind?
I was thinking like maybe grouping, but I guess that's multiple files. Searching.
Well, but when you search in a collection of something. So I would make the collection the objects of the command. But I agree with you that sometimes there are things that are not all that clear, and it's okay to have exceptions. I'm always very suspicious when something is supposed to work in every possible case. But yes, good point.
Suppose we consider writing in a WordPad. So which will be the object? Writing text. Text will be object or WordPad?
Writing like handwriting or typing?
Typing.
So okay.
The text is the object or file is the object here?
I don't know. What do you guys think?
The file?
Okay. The text is an object?
In this case?
Well, the thing is, you will have compound objects. So a document, a text document, will contain text elements. Maybe you want to look at them in terms of sections. But that's a decision you have to make, and I have examples coming up with drawings, not text, but they are similar. It forces you to decide what is an object, what is not an object. So I think here, if you think of it as adding text, inputting text to a document, it tells me that, you know, the content of the document itself is not an object of interest. And so once you want to have the ability to turn text bold, for example, well, what is going to be the object there? So at some point, the text, the words and sentences are going to be objects of interest. But you can describe that an object like the document, as part of its properties, contain a set of sections or a set of characters or a set of other objects. So by this, through the properties, you can describe sort of the hierarchy of objects you're dealing with. Right? Yes? So here's an example of how this works in practice for a concrete example. And I'm going to take two examples that are quite close, specifically to show how they are different. Well, you all know tools like Photoshop, which let you edit pixel-based images, yes? And tools like Illustrator that let you edit vector-based images or geometric shapes. So the thing is that if you are to create a new Photoshop, a new Illustrator, how would you go about this, deciding this conceptual model in the terms I've described? The first thing to ask yourself is, well, as I said before, what are the objects of interest? Well, in the end, I want to use these tools to create images, right? Now, the thing is images, yes. And it's clear that I can create the exact same image with the two types of tools. Now, they are going to be different in the way I create the images and how I can manipulate this image. So let's take this simple example where I have this rectangle and the circle on top of it. Now, what is this drawing made of, and how did I create this drawing? Okay, so you see geometric shapes. Yes, everybody does? Okay. Well, but maybe it's a set of pixels. And if it's a set of pixels, I could erase through them. And even though I perceive it as shapes, in fact, they were not shapes. But it's true that they can also be shapes, in which case they are superimposed one on top of the other so that I can take the circle and move it. Now, if I try to do something like this with Illustrator, it would be hard. I would have to create a shape. I mean, I wanted to have a squiggle rather than just a straight line, but PowerPoint is vector-based and didn't let me do it. So it would be very hard. And similarly, if I've created this drawing at the top with Photoshop, and then I want to turn into this one, and forget about layers. We're not talking about layers, huh? I know. That would be painful. I would have to essentially restart from scratch. In fact, oops, I can also change the superposition order, because even without layers, in Illustrator, you have an order of objects. So we see that depending on how we think of this image, the types of tools that I want to give the user are very different. And the way the user thinks of the objects is also different. Shapes versus a bunch of pixels. So that gives rise to these two families of image editing tools, one for editing bitmaps, where images are made out of a matrix of pixels, where the basic objects you manipulate are pixels, but you don't manipulate the pixels one by one, very rarely so. In fact, you have specialized editors, you know, the people who do icons, like 16 by 16 pixel icons, they have things where they edit pixel by pixel, because it's a very, in fact, it's very difficult to do good designs with so few pixels. But in Photoshop, typically you select areas and you operate on sets of pixels at a time. And so the basic operations become, and anybody who's used Photoshop knows that, you know, you need to select, and you have all these tools for doing fancy selection, and then you apply an operation to the pixels in that area. Now, by contrast, if you're editing vectors or shapes, the images are made of geometrical shapes. The basic objects is a stack of these vector-based objects. And so the basic operations is you want to create a new shape, modify its geometry, modify its graphical attributes. So the geometry is the shape itself. The graphical attributes is how it looks, what color is the border, the background, etc. And maybe change the stacking order, the order of superposition of the shape. So already there, we have two very different types of operations now, and not just objects. So if we start to translate that into the tables, the interaction tables I talked about. Well, so here I started with the operations. It's interesting. Why is that? The objects are later on, but it's okay. You can start with operations if that works for you. So what I said is there was an operation to select a set of pixels, and in Photoshop you have many different ways of specifying a selection. So I picked two here: the rectangle selection and the lasso selection. So in rectangle selection, you select the rectangle tool, you click. You drag, you get your rectangle. The cursor changes, so you know you are actually doing the rectangular selection. You get the ghost of the rectangle as you draw it, so you know where you are. And once you've done with the selection, to make the selection visible, there is a thing that is called the marching ants. You know what's the marching ants? Yeah, so it's little dash pattern that moves as if it were little ants walking around the thing. Right?
Is it the official name for it?
Yes, Adobe calls it that.
Okay.
Yeah. And then the other thing, which is the lasso selection, I select a different tool, and then here I can really outline the area itself. So that's an example where the same actions, depending on the tool, will have different effects. With the rectangle, I draw the diagonal. Here, I have to draw the whole outline. But the feedback and response is pretty much the same. Now, the thing is that I think you could make a case that in Photoshop, the selection itself is an object. Because once you have created a selection, there's a whole bunch of things you can do to it. You can expand it or contract it or add to it or remove from it. And so if I were to do the full conceptual model of Photoshop, which would be quite a daunting task because there are so many things in Photoshop, but if I were to do that, I would probably consider selection as an object. In fact, I think you can even save a selection, right? Anybody is Photoshop expert here? Yeah, I think you can save a selection as an object and then get it back. And so I think that's, again, thinking about the process of reification is very interesting when something, when a new type of object appears as you design your interface. And then there are things you do to the selection, or rather to the pixels that are specified by the selection. So for example, the paint brush, it acts inside the area that you have selected. So to paint a particular area, you select a brush tool, and then you ink in the inside the selected area. The cursor changes every time you select the tool. It displays the ink as you go. And usually, I don't know if this is still true because computers are so much more powerful now, but it used to be the case that, you know, you would paint, and then at the end, it took a second or two to really do it properly, especially when you use transparency and things like this. Another approach is to select the paint bucket tool. So then you just click inside the selection, and it fills it with the paint you selected. Other examples of operations. As I say, change the selected area. So I can invert the selection, meaning what was selected is not selected and vice versa. Since it's a command in the menu, there is no feedback. I mean, I don't have to explain that there's a feedback of the menu itself here. It's kind of obvious. But then the response is that, in fact, in the response is you don't really see the difference in the display after you've inverted, because the marching ants are the same. It's just that the area that's selected is the other one. Extending the selection, which will grow the area you have selected by one pixel. And then I can apply transformations to the parts that are selected. So there are many transformations you can do in Photoshop. One of them is itself a whole category, which is apply a filter to the selected area. And usually when you apply a filter, it comes with its own dialog box, so to set parameters. And then sometimes you have a preview, and then you see the result. So the point here is that, well, it's kind of painstaking, but you go through all the things that the system should do. So now, what are the objects we dealt with here? Well, as I said in the beginning, the main type of objects we deal with is an area. An area that is represented by this blinking outline. And we saw how to define a selection or one of these areas, to modify it, fill it. So this was one of the some of the pictures we saw, some of the operations we saw before. Now, in the course of this, if you think over the paint operation, the paint operation uses a brush. And the brush has its own characteristic. It can be thicker or smaller. It can have a shape. It can have a transparency, a color. And so it makes sense to treat brush as a first-class object in the system. In fact, in Photoshop, you can save brushes into files. You can load them, etc. And so you can go online and download the fancy brushes and stuff like this. So a brush is an object in itself. Another object that may be convenient to consider as such is a tool palette. Now, this one is tricky because I said before, you know, a button or a menu is not an object of interest. So why is it suddenly that the tool palette, I mean, tool palette is kind of a glorified menu. So why do I put a tool palette as an object here? Well, I decided to put it as an object because I want to give the user power over that object, right? In fact, in Photoshop, you can create, you can manipulate the palettes, move them around, put them together in one window. You can, it takes some programming, I believe, but you can create your own palette, you can recompose palettes. So something becomes an object in a model if the user has power over it. If I had a menu, for example, that the user can reconfigure, that menu could become an object in my conceptual model. But the edit menu, cut, copy, paste, that's not going to move, that's just there, I don't think of it as an object of interest. It's just there. If I can modify it, manipulate it, save it, create new ones, etc., if I can do all these things, then it sort of gets lifted to the status of conceptual object. Does this make sense? Yes. OK, now let's see what happens with vector-based editing. Well, so what we said is that in vector-based editing, you have to first be able to create these new shapes. And we said that the shape, an object had a shape and some visual attributes. So how do you create shapes in an Illustrator-like tool? Well, typically you have a palette with different basic shapes, circles and rectangles and stars, etc. And typically there are two types of objects. One that you can specify, which is just an enclosing box. So you select that object, you click and you drag, and you get a new shape whose size is specified by this rectangle you just drew. But for more complex shapes, like what's called a polyline or a polygon, you have to click and specify each of what is called the control points. So all the corners of the polygon. And if you're creating curves, for each point you also need to specify the curvature. And so you have a process here where you select that tool, the pencil, and then you click and drag each point to specify where you want your curve to go through and what tangent should be like at each of these points. In both cases, you end up with a new shape. And as part of this process, note that you specify the shape, not the attributes. So what is your shape going to look like? What color is it going to have? What thickness? I don't know. How does it work? Any Illustrator user here? Yes? What was the question? Well, once I create a shape, what is what graphical attributes is it using?
By default, well, it depends what the. I actually depends what you selected last. But otherwise, it's mainly the border, the background.
Yeah, but which
value?
Which value does it take?
If you selected something previously, it takes the same value. Or by default, it's like white background and black border of 1 pixel.
Okay. Yes? Actually, I don't know. I don't use Illustrator very often. So but I know Illustrator confuses the hell out of me every time I use it, especially selection. And so, yes, I think there's... I think you're right that it depends on what you did last, which... You know, usually when systems try to be too clever, they are more frustrating than not. It's a little bit like the word completion. You know, when it does the autocorrection right, it's like, yes. When it does it wrong, it's like the cost of error is very high. This kind of thing where, you know, the system is using... So, for example, when you're aligning objects... you select multiple ones and you click align. Do you know where it's going to align?
At the topmost.
So the topmost.
The
first object that
the first object you selected?
Depends.
It depends. I think you're right. I'm sure. I don't know, for Illustrator specifically, you seem to be sure of yourself, so I trust you. But I know the what you say, the first one, is also true some of the time. But that's a case where the system is trying to be clever or to help you, but in a way that is not intuitive. Because to me, if it were one, it would be more likely the last one than the first one. The topmost, I don't know. Is that a good idea?
Well, usually if you're aligning left or right or top or bottom,
yeah,
the one that is most to that value, it will align to that.
Okay, so it's really pushing them
to the extreme
in that direction. Okay, well, that's I hadn't thought of it this way. Good.
Actually, it depends, because you can select different modes for alignment, and if you select the mode to align either in the world, so the whole document, or in the selection,
right,
then it keeps the last value.
Okay.
So it's also again.
So it's complicated, and what you see is that, you know, the way we specify the operations here is do something to that object. And that's usually fairly easy to turn into a particular interaction, because oftentimes you're going to select the object first and then say apply that command or operation to it. Right? Things get tricky when you have multiple objects that are involved, like in an alignment, or like when creating a shape involves specifying both the shape itself, the points of the shape, and the graphical attributes. And so instead of, for example, here you create the shape and then it pops up a window, say, well, what color do you want it, etc., it's using default values that are taken somehow from the context. But it's always tricky to anticipate what this context is. And so I think if you can think of a design, maybe by introducing new objects, where you have commands that don't require additional parameters or don't require defaults, it will make the interface usually simpler to understand. Problem is that oftentimes getting things simpler to understand means making them less efficient for an expert user, and we get into this trade-off, again, of power versus simplicity. But what I've noticed is something that frustrates me in Illustrator and Photoshop, if you're not a regular user, is that there's all these behaviors that have been obviously carefully designed, but really targeting expert users, and they're not really intuitive to the first-time user. And I think if you deconstruct this interface and turn it into this kind of analysis here, you could come up with better ways of making the system easier to predict. So here are other operations that you want to do. So the shapes have a geometry and attributes. So you want to be able to modify the geometry of an object, and you want to be able to modify the attributes. So geometry, usually you click the object, you see this little handles, and then you do sort of a direct manipulation of the handles to reshape the object. And to modify the attributes, usually it's using an attribute inspector, because there are whole sets of attributes that can depend on the object you are editing. And then the question is, if it's an inspector, do you see the effect immediately, or is it a dialog box where you have to change things and then click OK to see the effect? Finally, changing the stacking order, which was the other specific aspect of vector editing. While you have this bring to front, send to back, bring forward, move backwards, that's another one that drives me crazy, because in general, what I want to do is not to put the objects all the way in the front or all the way in the back, but I want to make an object to the front enough so it's visible, but not more. I don't know. Is that just me, or? Yeah. And so, again, that's an example where I think you could do a better job in fact, what I think is the stacking order is not a very good idea, because when you have two objects that are side by side that don't overlap each other, for the system, one of them is in front of the other, right? But for you, it's not. If I had two pieces of paper side by side, they're side by side. They're not on top of each other. And usually, it's the one I'm going to move that I want to put on top of the other, right? So, you know, we could imagine a way to manipulate the stacking order that would be more consistent with what we sort of naturally do when we organize pieces of paper on the desk. And I had actually, this is an idea I've had for a long time, so I'd created a little prototype where what you could do is take an object that was hidden, partially hidden, so you click and drag it, and then when you move it back, it goes on top. Like you pull a sheet from under a pile of paper, and then you put it on top. But you did this just by moving the object. You didn't have any extra thing or doing the bring forward, etc. Anyway, changing the stacking order, there are several ways of doing it. I think what we do now in current systems, which is really this simple commands, should be more powerful. And to finish with that example, what are the objects that we played with? Well, we have this vector-based shapes where you have the geometry and the graphical attributes are the main properties of that thing. You represent it by a graphical shape. You want to be able to create, modify the geometry, change the attributes, and, of course, delete it as well. And change the stacking order, which I didn't have room to put in here. The attribute inspector is an interesting thing because, you know, when you do heavy-duty editing, you spend a lot of time with that attribute inspector. And in some systems, you can actually reconfigure them so they better match I'm thinking of OmniGraffle. Anybody knows OmniGraffle? Well, it's a tool to make diagrams, so it doesn't have all the power of Illustrator, which is more for drawings types of illustrations. OmniGraffle is more for diagrams like flowcharts or things like this. But the attribute inspector, you can reorder the order of the sections. You can close sections you don't want to see. You can open others. And so you can really sort of shape it to your needs. And so I think, again, it's a case where, to me, it makes sense to consider it as an object in itself because user has some kind of power over it. Okay, so I hope these examples have sort of made it a little bit more clear what these interaction tables are for. So here are now my rules for creating these things. So in the real system, these tables are going to grow pretty big. In fact, I've been looking for several years now for a student who would like to implement a tool to help manage these tables on the computer and do a number of things that are here listed under completeness and consistency, so it would make it easier to build these tables. So if anybody's interested in that kind of internship, there you go. One thing that works well is to organize the operations by categories. So you can group things that are about managing the workspace, you know, the tool palettes and the inspectors I talked about and the windows, etc. Then for the tools we talked about, you could separate the local editing of individual objects from the global editing of the layout. Find a way to organize things, which maybe will translate into different modes in your interface. or at least will make it easy to find things. The value of these tables is that you can then analyze them and identify problems or opportunities. The first one is to verify completeness. Every operation that in the right column of the object table should be somewhere in the left column of the operations table. That's really the minimum thing you can expect. But also look at each property and see whether it is visible in some representation or not, whether it is editable or not with some operation or other. And if it's not, make sure that you know why it's not, and that's fine too. But at least it gives you a way to check systematically. Another thing you can do is verify consistency. Look that similar interactions have similar effects. Look like similar types of operations, like create or delete, or have similar interactions. And what you'll find is, you know, for a particular case, you'll have an interaction that you put in that, in fact, could work for other operations as well that you wouldn't have think of otherwise. So it helps with making the overall interface both more consistent, but at the same time, usually more powerful because you think of new interactions you hadn't thought about. Additional rules is you remember the design principles from instrumental interaction. And you can apply them in that context: reification, polymorphism, reuse. Reification, can we identify new objects like the brushes that I talked about, or the guidelines for alignment? And you have new objects, and then you can think of the operations on those objects, etc. Polymorphism, create commands that can apply to different types of objects. So, I don't know, if I have tools to, if I have the guideline to align objects in my drawing, could it also be used to align tool palettes? Maybe it's a silly example, but I can at least ask myself these questions. And last example is reuse. You want to facilitate output reuse as well as input reuse. Output reuse means that you want to favor commands that use existing objects as input, like duplicating things or creating an object that represents a set of attributes, what we usually call a style, so that then you can reuse that style and etc. And finally, how do you evaluate the quality of your conceptual model? Needless to say, anything you can do at this stage without starting to do detailed design of your wireframes and how things like will look like, and even more before starting to program anything, everything that you will do at this stage will save you a lot of time and energy and trouble later on. It's the same thing as, I'm sure you've been told if you've taken any software engineering class, that any problem you detect, you know, when you write the specification will cost a lot less than if you detect it when, you know, your system has been installed on a million machines and suddenly a bug shows up. So different things that work well, and some of these you will learn more about them in Wendy's bootcamp class, where you will actually also, normally she does that, use the interaction tables, using scenarios and storyboard. So, how many of you have knowledge of agile methods? Yes? So in agile, I think we call that user stories. Yeah? It's the basic idea. Is you take concrete things, if possible, drawn from users, real cases, but you turn them into little stories. So the user, you know, should be able to do this and that and get to that result. And then you try to see, well, given what I have in my conceptual model, even though I don't have the interface in front of me, how would you go about creating this drawing, for example? Well, you would have to do this, do that, and you can check that you have all the commands you need. Maybe when you do this, it can give you ideas for more commands, but it gives you a good idea of coverage. A walkthrough is a different type. It's similar but different in that in a walkthrough, you take a particular set of actions, sort of a story but detailed in terms of what actions to do, and then you look at it specifically with particular criteria in mind, like the ones we saw in previous slides, in terms of consistency or in terms of something else. And so again, it allows you to verify that things are, for example, consistent. And then there's always a point where you cannot decide what is the best design, or you have an idea about a design for a particular feature, but you don't know if it's actually going to work. And then that's where you can make prototypes. But these are very specific prototypes to check one idea. So the little video I showed you 2 weeks ago, I think, of the sticky lines, of the guidelines, not the sticky lines, which was a real fully functional prototype, but the one I had done a long time ago in TickleTK was very simple. That was an idea just, you know, quick and dirty implementation to check that the idea was as good as we thought. And it's okay to create these very specific prototypes if you need an answer that you cannot get otherwise. Okay, in conclusion, the conceptual model is at the heart of an interactive system. Well, I wish this was written in all books on designing user interfaces, because I think the state of user interface design these days is kind of pathetic. The main idea is that, well, it's not hard to design an interface. Everybody knows how to do it. You know, I use something, I know what's wrong with it. So if I know what's wrong with that interface, sure, I can build the right interface. Well, experience shows that it's not the case. Maybe you can build one that is right for you, and even that leaves to be proven. But it's not true. It's hard. It's hard. And in fact, the better the interface in terms of its seeming simple and word I don't like, natural, it's because a lot of work has gone into it, right? And it's a lot of work that requires a combination of skills from that includes, of course, graphic design skill and visual design skill and programmer skill in making things that are responsive in the sense of being fast, not responsive design, which is another story altogether, but that is fast enough that you don't feel that it's sluggish, etc. But if you don't have the right concept in the beginning, you know, the best graphic designers won't be able to save you. And so identifying these key things of what are the objects, what are the operations, what is the core really of the stuff I want to interact with, and then what do I put to mediate my interaction with this content or these objects is really critical. You cannot do it by simply applying rules. Rules help, but what helps with rules is to learn when and how to break them. Don't forget about the user, and the techniques you will see with Wendy will help you to work with users with participatory design techniques. Users won't give you the solution. Sometimes they will, but don't expect that they will. But users will help you identify not only the problems, but also the things that are not needed, not necessary, not useful. And all too often, you know, in software engineering, there's this rule that 80% of the time of execution of a piece of software is spent on 20% of the code, right? You heard of that? The 80-20? Well, there's a lot of dead code in software, essentially, or things that are run once, and that's it. So you spend a lot of the time in a very small amount of the code. And then people spend enormous amount of time optimizing things that get executed once. So it's useless. I think in user interface also, we spend too much time on things that never get used, and sometimes not enough in those that get used the most. And so it's by interacting with users that you can learn about that. And that's why we believe in participatory design, that if you involve your users along the design process, you better understand their needs, and you can better concentrate your efforts in the things that count. And you can also take advantage of the ideas and suggestions that they may have. Even though, again, participatory design does not mean having the user design for you. Okay, well, that's all the slides I have for today. Questions? Yes?
So would you recommend always doing an interaction table before doing any drawing or any?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, if you don't know what you're designing for, you know, you can do all the wireframes in the world. It's really important to know what are, again, objects and operations are the key. And there are obvious ones, but the important work is to refine them as you go, because you will find that, oh, maybe I can consider this an object, and it's going to give new power to my interface. And so it's like programming, you know, the later you start coding, the better.